Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the CFR Academic Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org, if you would like to share it with your colleagues or classmates. We're delighted to have Thomas Boyke with us today to discuss non-communicable diseases in the developing world. Mr. Boyke is an adjunct professor of law at Georgetown University and consultant to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, in addition to his position here at CFR. Prior to coming to CFR, he was a fellow at the Center for Global Development and Director of Intellectual Property and Pharmaceutical Policy at the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative. He was also a Fulbright Scholar to South Africa, where he worked as a staff attorney at the AIDS Law Project on treatment access issues related to HIV/AIDS. Welcome, Thomas. Thank you very much for being with us today. It would be great if you could give us an overview of what non-communicable diseases are and how they're affecting the developing world.
Sure. It's thank you for that kind introduction. It's my pleasure to participate in this call and talk about non-communicable diseases. The way I'm going to do that is I'll talk a little bit about how these are affecting low and middle income countries and what these diseases are, and talk a bit about the differences in terms of their effects and causes in those countries, and then move on to what is being done about them, both internationally and on behalf of the U.S. government to address these this international problem. And then, if we have a little time at the end, I'll lay out what I think is an agenda for achieving more progress on these issues in the future. The dominant health challenges facing low- and middle-income countries are changing. Diabetes, cardiovascular disease, cancer, chronic respiratory illnesses, these are now overtaking the diseases that most of us think of as being the dominant health challenges for low- and middle-income countries, those being HIV/AIDS, malaria, tuberculosis, and other infectious diseases. Now these non-communicable diseases, again, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, cancer, and the like, are the leading cause of death and disability in every region of the world except sub-Saharan Africa, where they will also overtake infectious diseases in the next decade or so. The non-communicable diseases are now representative of 80% of the deaths from non-communicable diseases occur in low- and middle-income countries. That's about 30 million each year. To give you a sense of scale on that, that figure is roughly equivalent as if everyone who is living with HIV worldwide were to die each and every year from non-communicable diseases. It's that many people, 30 million. It's really a spectacular number. Another way of giving you a sense of that scale, in 2011, the number of just cardiovascular deaths in low- and middle-income countries were more than 1.5 times the combined annual deaths from HIV/AIDS, malaria, and TB worldwide. This epidemic of non-communicable diseases looks different in low- and middle-income countries than in countries like the United States and other high-income countries. It's arising in younger populations, growing more rapidly and having much poorer health outcomes than we've ever seen in countries like the U.S. I mentioned before that 80% of the annual deaths from NCDs now occur in low and middle income countries. That figure was just 40% a little over a decade and a half ago. Almost half of the non-communicable disease deaths in low and middle income countries occur in working age people, as defined by the World Health Organization to be under 70. Non-communicable diseases that are preventable or treatable in developed countries are often death sentences in developing countries. Whereas cervical cancer here in the U.S. can largely be prevented thanks to a vaccine, in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, it is the leading cause of death from cancer among women. Juvenile diabetes, which deaths from juvenile diabetes are quite rare in high-income settings. It is a leading cause of death in some regions of the world. Is very high. The mortality rate in China from stroke is 4 to 6 times as high as it is in France and Japan or the United States. 90% of the children with leukemia in high-income countries are cured, but 90% of those with that disease in the world's 25 poorest countries die from it. It's not just a health impact, though, that you're having from these diseases. According to the World Economic Forum's 2009 Global Risk Reports, non-communicable diseases now present the greatest threat to global economic development other than climate change, exceeding anything like from fiscal crises to natural disasters, from corruption to infectious disease. Non-communicable diseases are a bigger threat to global development than all of those. The causes of these diseases also look different in low- and middle-income countries. In high-income countries, non-communicable diseases, diabetes, cancer, and the like are driven by increases in obesity, sedentary lifestyle, excessive alcohol consumption, salty foods, that sort of thing. And it's overwhelming our systems to really, it's a cost issue to some extent here. It's overwhelming our ability to pay for the bad outcomes of those diseases. In low- and middle-income countries, though, the epidemic's being driven by different factors. What has happened in low- and middle-income countries is that life expectancies have increased as a result of better vaccination campaigns and the diffusion of good public health practices like breastfeeding, hand washing, oral rehydration to protect children from cholera, that sort of thing. That's good news, but these increases of longevity have occurred without the gains in personal wealth and the better health systems that accompanied the rise in longevity that occurred in a lot of high-income countries decades, in some cases centuries ago. There's persistent poverty in low- and middle-income countries. 2.5 billion people live on less than $2 a day. That's despite all we hear about the rising incomes in low- and middle-income countries. You still have a big pool of persistently poor. Most of those people live in middle-income countries, such as India and China and Pakistan. Healthcare spending is quite low in many low- and middle-income countries. It's expanding slowly in Latin America, Middle East, and parts of Asia, but remains incredibly low, particularly in Africa. To give some sense of the scale, the 38 countries of sub-Saharan Africa spend less on healthcare than the state of Connecticut does. Regulation of tobacco, alcohol, and processed foods in many developing countries is nearly non-existent. This compounds the challenge of poverty and inadequate health care systems by increasing the likelihood that poor people will develop a non-communicable disease. And then, of course, they don't have the health systems that are very capable of treating them. Increased global integration of tobacco, food, and beverage markets are overwhelming the little health infrastructure that does exist in these countries. Low- and middle-income country markets are the growth markets for multinationals in these industries, but you don't have the system set up that you have in many high-income settings, as insufficient as they can be. Even in the United States, sometimes they're significantly worse in low- and middle-income countries, and without that system, health systems and regulatory systems to adapt, it's leading to bad outcomes. The last factor I just want to mention that's really driving the NCD epidemic in low- and middle-income countries is urbanization. In 1950, 70% of the world's population lived in towns and villages. In 2008, we've now passed the threshold where the majority of the world's population now lives in urban environments. Most of this urbanization has occurred in low- and middle-income countries and in many places where cities have had where there's little infrastructure to support that urbanization. The result has been slums. 90% of the world's slums are in developing countries, and they house now nearly 1 billion people. Access to nutrition and public health education in slums is lower, and consumption of tobacco and unhealthy foods and the other risk factors behind non-communicable diseases are higher in those settings, particularly among the poor. The good thing about non-communicable diseases, and there aren't many, is that the many of the solutions to this problem are relatively known. The World Bank estimates that developing countries could lower their projected rates of disability and death from non-communicable diseases by half if they were to raise taxes or restrict marketing of tobacco and alcohol, if they were to put restrictions in place on the content of salt and trans fats in foods, and by using medications such as beta blockers, aspirin, and other low-cost interventions to control non-communicable diseases. Most of these tools are available. Treatments for non-communicable diseases, the most effective treatments for non-communicable diseases, such as insulin and asthma inhalers, are not on patent. They are widely available in high-income countries, but they are not widely available in many low- and lower-middle-income countries. And without the access to those treatments, there's much otherwise avoidable disability and death that occurs. Despite the solutions being known, the international community has struggled to date to address this problem. The World Health Organization first called attention to the non-communicable disease epidemic in 1996 in its groundbreaking Global Burden of Disease report, and despite that, really struggled to generate attention and funding to address this problem. Donors remained focused on the battle against infectious diseases and were reluctant to divert their funds to non-communicable diseases. So in order to try to generate more attention, governments from the Caribbean and a number of non-governmental organizations joined together to try to take a page from the playbook on HIV/AIDS and propose a UN high-level meeting at the General Assembly that would be dedicated to non-communicable diseases. It would be the second General Assembly meeting on health ever. The HIV/AIDS version had really managed to elevate that issue onto the international agenda. It mobilized billions in donor resources to support access to treatment and really helped build a popular movement to address HIV and spread action on the country level. The UN General Assembly meeting, which occurred in September 2011, has had less dramatic consequences. The good news from that meeting is that more than 100 countries sent representatives, including 30 heads of states, to attend the meeting. There was and there continues to be media interest in the problem. The meeting initiated a process at the World Health Organization to develop consensus on the indicators that can help monitor non-communicable diseases and their risk factors worldwide and help convince governments to try to develop plans for addressing the problem. They've put forward one recently on a commitment to reduce premature deaths from non-communicable diseases by 25% by 2025. These are all modest good news. The bad news is that you haven't really seen the popular attention, the patient movement, or the resources that were generated around HIV. You haven't seen those types of things happening on non-communicable diseases internationally. There has been no patient movement. Official development aid for non-communicable diseases remains exactly where it was before the UN meeting, which is 3%. The World Health Organization's most recent budget for 2012, it's actually less than 3%, will be devoted to non-communicable diseases and their risk factors. And most of the commitments that emerged from the UN meeting were rhetorical, not setting forth mandatory targets or mandatory reduction plans. So I think that result has disappointed many to date. With that gloomy introduction, I can say, though, I think progress is possible in non-communicable diseases. I just think it requires more prioritization. The international community should focus its efforts on the non-communicable diseases and risk factors that are especially prevalent in the developing country poor and the particular needs of their governments to address them. A more targeted approach would build stronger international support for concrete action. It would also minimize the number of potential opponents. One of the challenges the international movement on non-communicable diseases has had is that it has tried to address all these diseases and all these risk factors simultaneously. And I think that has diffused popular support for concrete action and mobilized a range of potential opponents to concrete action occurring by really linking anyone from the pharmaceutical industry to restaurants to food and beverage companies all together having a stake in the outcome of the UN meeting. And I think a more focused approach is likely to yield better action. Where this could occur is by concentrating on tobacco. Tobacco is an area in which evidence-based strategies for reducing tobacco use already exist. There is a international treaty on tobacco control that's widely subscribed. What tobacco as an international issue really lacks is adequate funding. It's tremendously underfunded. We could do more in that area. On other risk factors like alcohol, salt, trans fats, I think at this point, until we build better international consensus, I think we should focus on monitoring internationally the rise of those risk factors and their consequences to try to build international support for doing more in those areas and voluntary partnerships with industry. Since this is just not only a problem on the prevention side, you do need treatment as well, and expanding the existing procurement mechanisms that exist in the Global Fund or for vaccines to include essential medicines for non-communicable diseases would help increase the accessibility of those treatments in low- and middle-income countries. And the last thing that you could do in this area is to expand treatment platforms that exist in the world's poorest countries where non-communicable diseases and cancers aren't really driven so much by alcohol or tobacco use. It can be quite low in these settings, but really just by the fact that the healthcare systems are so poor. And there I think you can really leverage the programs that exist through the U.S. PEPFAR program to provide better treatment to serve those needs. So in sum, it's an enormous problem. Hasn't generated the support that it needs to yet, although is starting to get some attention. And I do think there are strategies that exist to move this issue forward if we can be a bit more targeted and prioritize those measures.
Terrific. Thank you very much for that interesting and sobering overview. Let's open up to questions now from the students.
At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touchtone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you'd like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, please dial star 2. Again, to ask a question, please dial star 1 on your touchtone phone now. Our first question will come from Florida A&M University. Please go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, please go ahead.
Who should be a part are in order to focus within a targeted approach to raise attention and resources to this problem of non-communicable disease? I mean, do you have somebody specifically or what specifically can be done?
Great. It's a great question. I think in terms of institutions or governments to lead this effort, I think there is certainly a lot the U.S. government, a lot more the U.S. government can do on these issues that would be quite low cost. The big challenge for NCDs are a different challenge than a lot of global health and humanitarian crises in the past, where you could, it's more of an issue about delivering essential medicines and food, no matter what the current status of that government might be. You could deliver those items even to settings in which governments were largely non-existent. That's not true on non-communicable diseases. You need a more sustained intervention. You need prevention programs. You need treatment programs. And where the U.S. government, I think, has a large role to play here is its technical agencies, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, providing the technical support that low- and middle-income country governments need to start to tackle this problem. Another area is piloting, providing small amounts of funding to pilot programs to determine what can work in these emerging market nations. I think there's this is an area that requires some amount of pilot programs to build consensus. I mentioned before in some of the areas other than tobacco control, there's more evidence needed to how to establish these programs. Those are just some of the measures that can be done. I think on the international side, of course, there's the World Health Organization that has played a role in this and certainly can do more moving forward. I think you might see more progress occurring at regional entities like the Pan American Health Organization, which convene states that have similar cultures, economic circumstances, and disease challenges. Moving on these issues regionally might provide a better platform for action.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from University of South Carolina. Again, if you have a question, dial star one.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can, yeah.
Hi. So in one of the readings, the background readings for this conference call, talked about the shortage of primary health care workers, the shortage of hospitals worldwide, and the increasing need of universal health care. So, of course, you know, these are much more longer-term initiatives, which, you know, it's hard to train, you know, millions of healthcare workers, build thousands of hospitals. So what can we do in the short term to make up the shortfall in primary care? Do you see something like telemedicine as something which could change the landscape of global medicine? What can we do in the short term to increase access to healthcare?
Yeah, great question. There has been a push on universal healthcare as a way of addressing non-communicable diseases. I agree with you. I think it's my own personal view is it's a long-term initiative. And as an international initiative to push for universal health care, I think it's more of an issue of working with governments for each government to tackle how to design those universal health care systems on their own. Because if you look at the pattern where you have national health care systems, every model has been pretty different. That's my personal view. On what can be done in the shorter term, you're starting to see some uses of peer networks as a way of building healthcare institutions. So the program, Paul Farmer's program, Partners in Health, has recently established a hospital that will focus on cancer in Rwanda. That provides a good example of this. There are seven U.S. Universities that will be sending rotating medical faculty through this hospital, also participating in, as you mentioned, telemedicine and other links as a way of trying to build up the standard of care being provided in those environments so you don't have to train millions of healthcare workers, develop large pools of doctors in these settings, that you would be able to leverage the expertise that exists elsewhere. I think it's a great program and a great idea. Whether or not it's scalable in every country and that has a need for something like this, I think is a different issue. But it's certainly a good start and one that I will be watching. It would be worth watching for others as well.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from St. Edward's University.
Hello. I was wondering what you think is preventing the global support for these non-communicable diseases today.
It's a great question. I think it's a combination. One is I think there are a lot of misperceptions about the non-communicable disease epidemic that exists in low- and middle-income countries. I think many have assumed, because these diseases are present in high-income countries, that the forces driving them are really the same in low-income countries. And people feel, well, you know, I look around me and, you know, my relative had cancer, or I know someone with diabetes, and this is just a byproduct of economic development. You know, we're struggling to deal with these issues here, so how can we intervene to help low- and middle-income countries when we can't even address these problems here? So that's one of the issues. I think also for many, the fact that the risk factors are behavioral, meaning people, things such as tobacco use, or salt and alcohol intake are behavioral. People feel like it's not like HIV or other issues where there's a sense that it's the patient's fault in these environments, so somehow less worthy of international intervention. So I think those are part of the issue. The other one I would mention is, I think, as I discussed in my remarks, the lack of prioritization. I think when people talk about needing to build universal healthcare systems in order to tackle non-communicable diseases, it just seems overwhelming to people as a global health intervention, too big. I actually think all of those issues are wrong or misperceptions. In terms of the factors driving non-communicable disease, we discussed them in the call. It actually is a very different epidemic in low and middle-income countries than it is here. A lot of the means to reduce that are things that exist widely in high-income countries, and it's a matter of capacity in low- and middle-income countries to implement them. You could do a lot to reduce the burden of this non-communicable disease epidemic in these settings if you really were just to make some of the low-cost interventions available in low- and middle-income countries. And on the behavioral side, it's a funny argument because ultimately HIV was once considered a behavioral disease as well, primarily the method by which it's transmitted in sub-Saharan Africa has been through sexual contact, in that particular case primarily heterosexual contact, but it was seen if people were able to reduce at-risk behaviors, it would reduce the HIV epidemic. And I think what one realizes is that the forces driving these things are often tied to, again, challenges of poverty and education and lack of awareness of the risk, adoption of behaviors fairly early. Again, as we discuss in low and middle income countries, even to the extent you have these risk factors, they play a much larger role. It is driven far more by lack of healthcare capacity. You see minor shifts in obesity and consumption of alcohol and tobacco in some of these environments, leading to far worse health outcomes because, again, these lack of capacity to address the problems. Anyway, but those are the reasons why I think you've seen less action and why I think those reasons would be incorrect.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from UCLA. Please go ahead.
Hi. In one of your articles, you stated that NCDs don't need to take away funds from infectious diseases, but rather create its own path and generate its own resources. How much support do you get from the leadership of these developing countries to do this?
It's a great question. In terms of pulling funding away from infectious diseases, I think one of the big debates is, so the U.S. global health budget is something in the area of $8.5 billion a year, which, again, in comparison to the amount, it sounds like a lot of money, but in comparison to what we spend on a variety of other international programs, particularly defense, it's actually a fairly small amount. But the vast majority of that funding goes towards the PEPFAR program and HIV/AIDS. As I mentioned before, HIV/AIDS does not represent anywhere near the burden of death and disability that non-communicable diseases do in low- and middle-income countries. And as a expanding problem, is unlikely, it's not expanding at nearly the same rate as the NCD epidemic. This has led a lot of global health commentators to suggest that we should shift some of the funding from HIV/AIDS to non-communicable diseases. I'm of the view that the funding that was generated around HIV/AIDS had to do with the unique dynamic around that disease. Particularly, it came up at a time, 2003, 2004, where there is needs to balance U.S. programs or concern about the war in Iraq that helped drive, in part, more U.S. intervention on global health programs. There was concern about the increase of AIDS orphans and A combination of factors really generated the funding that exists around the U.S. PEPFAR program. I don't think you can say the same combination of factors would exist around non-communicable diseases, so therefore it's easy just to shift the money. I think non-communicable diseases will need to make their own case to do this. I also think in terms of support from low and middle income countries, I think it's a great point. I think a lot of this will have to occur at the country level. And as I suggested in response to one of the other questions, I think it's more of an issue of U.S. partnership with these countries to help them, provide them with the expertise and wherewithal to be able to implement some of the solutions that we do know out there to start to address this NCD problem. Much less than the huge amounts of money that needed to be mobilized to pay for and distribute antiretroviral medications.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from McAllister College. Please go ahead.
Hi, I have a question about the tobacco industry. You said there should be an international effort to reduce or restrict tobacco use in middle and low-income countries. But in reality, we all know that this industry is really powerful, and in poor countries especially, where governments have less influence on regulations, how do you think an action can be materialized?
Another good question. I should say up front, there is already an international movement to reduce tobacco control or reduce tobacco use in low and middle income countries, and it is having good success. As some of you may have seen in the Wall Street Journal just a couple weeks ago, Russia announced a ban on public smoking or smoking in public places. Brazil recently became the first country to have a ban that covers the entire country on smoking in public places. This is a relatively new intervention. I mean, people, some people on the phone may be old enough to remember when the New York City adopted this close to the beginning of Mayor Bloomberg's tenure, and it was seen as quite controversial at the time and a limitation on personal liberty, and it is now being adopted worldwide. What has worked in tobacco control is to develop, first of all, they have a system of global surveillance that identifies what the use of tobacco is and the bad health effects that are emerging, so you have evidence. They've also piloted projects to determine what can work to address tobacco consumption in low- and middle-income countries, and through those pilots have developed a set of strategies for what you can do to control tobacco, and that has been put forward as well. But it hasn't just been around surveillance and developing strategies. They've actually, the Bloomberg Foundation, working with its partners like the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, have gone to countries and tried to tackle this problem from the ground up. They've built civil society movements. They've worked with media. They've worked with patient advocacy groups to try to build the support and accountability of governments to implement these programs. And it's effective. It has started to work. The challenge has been that they haven't been able yet to generate the resources to do this on a more extended basis. They are making progress, but in comparison, again, to a lot of other global health issues, international tobacco control is woefully underfunded. I think through the Bloomberg Foundation and the Gates Foundation, it receives something in the area of $100 million per year. From the U.S. government, I mentioned before, U.S. spends $8.5 billion on global health each year. In terms of what is spent on tobacco control, it's less than 0.01%, despite the fact that tobacco control or tobacco use is responsible for more deaths than HIV, malaria, and TB combined just on its own. So I do think with more funding, I think you could see, we're seeing success with more funding, you would see that success accelerate.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. As a quick reminder, if you have a question, please dial *1 on your touch-tone phone now. Our next question will come from Coastal Carolina University. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. Earlier you mentioned the U.S. being an aid, but do you think by the U.S. Helping these lower middle-income countries with diseases that will create a conflict later on? For example, the U.S. might feel like those lower middle-income countries are obligated to do what the U.S. wants them to do because the U.S. helped out?
It's true. I mean, the U.S., by saying countries should prioritize non-communicable diseases, can't make that happen on its own. So it has to be a partnership. The countries themselves have to want to take these measures. And I think, by and large, there's not much evidence to suggest that they don't. I think the challenge has been, again, around governance. While you've seen countries like China, India, and some of the other countries which are seeing the largest non-communicable disease problems, they've grown economically, but it takes a long time to build a healthcare system. It takes a long time to develop accountability and governance that you have had in high-income countries. And they're facing this challenge of non-communicable diseases and increasing trade in these products at rates that we just didn't see in high-income countries. This is you didn't have these expansion of life expectancy in the U.S. or the United Kingdom happen at the same time that you've seen these rates of urbanization and increased international trade leading to greater increased risk factors for non-communicable diseases. This is a unique challenge for them. I think there is appetite for support. I just think the support hasn't been forthcoming. So I think if the U.S. were and its partners were able to do more in this area, I think you would see more uptake in low- and middle-income countries.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Mesa Community College. Please go ahead.
Thank you for taking my question. Can everybody hear me? All right.
Yes.
Okay. I earlier we had addressed AIDS funding in the initial lecture that was given there, and then whether or not funds should be reappropriated from AIDS and HIV research. And it was mentioned that this holds an entirely different dynamic. But I think part of the issue appears to be getting buy-in for funding for non-communicable diseases. Particularly from the philanthropic efforts. And with HIV, there's obviously a big marketing point of this could devastate the species. I'm curious as to whether or not there are present more pressing concerns related to these common non-communicable diseases that would, I suppose, be used to market towards these philanthropists to direct their funds towards this as opposed to directing it towards the threat from AIDS. How can we appropriately market this to tell people that this is where your funding needs to go instead of funding the AIDS research?
Great. It's a great question and very nicely framed. I think that non-communicable diseases, what has been done to date is that advocacy efforts have emphasized its scale. It's leading to disastrous human consequences, huge amounts of loss and death and disability occurring as a result of these diseases. I mentioned before some of its economic consequences. Between now and 2030, non-communicable diseases are expected to cost low- and middle-income countries $14 trillion. That part of the advocacy to date has been there. I think where the advocacy has fallen short is presenting a very concrete and very targeted plan for addressing these diseases. I think why you saw resources be mobilized for HIV and some malaria and TB and other infectious diseases is there are plans in place about how international efforts could be used to address these challenges in low- and middle-income countries. I think to date, one of the problem has been in terms of the NCD advocacy community is the effort to try to do everything at once, promoting solutions such as universal health care, having to build universal health care systems before you can make progress on non-communicable diseases. I think that has done a disservice in terms of mobilizing action, and it's one of the reasons I have been pushing a much more targeted approach of starting where evidence and the platforms for interventions exist, such around tobacco control, building on existing infrastructure like procurement programs for drugs and vaccines that exist now, and on the PEPFAR program as a way of mobilizing action. And I think you can do that. The other point, just finally to emphasize there, is I don't, while I think non-communicable diseases are different from HIV/AIDS, they are have some similarity with other global health challenges that have mobilized a significant amount of funding, and particularly around maternal and child health. Maternal and child health challenges are not communicable either. U.S. citizens aren't at risk from poor maternal and child health in low and middle income countries, but they have mobilized support because the U.S. government and others have been committed to reducing avoidable death and disability that results from poverty and unequal access to the effective prevention and treatment measures that exist in countries like ours. I think the exact same motivations exist on non-communicable diseases, and if we can mobilize international efforts on maternal and child health, I think there's hope for non-communicable diseases as well.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. As a reminder, please dial star 1 to ask a question. Our next question will come from the University of South Carolina. Please go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to hear your thoughts on how you think we could address obesity in the developing world. I come from India, for instance, and there are a lot of social and cultural norms regarding obesity where sometimes people will be very obese, but they won't consider themselves obese. It's not that they don't want to be obese, it's just that they don't know enough about it. So how do you address, obesity and diabetes in the developing world, not just by having regulation on sugar and beverage companies, but also by changing these crucial social and cultural norms on obesity, on educating people that on these risk factors?
It's a good question. Obesity has been actually the issue on which the public health community, even in the United States, has really struggled to develop strategies that work. In the U.S., our population has been growing increasingly obese. We have a much higher prevalence of obesity now than we had 5 years ago, and then even more than we had before that. It's a growing challenge. The U.S. is a early adopter of the global obesity health threat. As I mentioned, in most low and middle income countries, the rates of obesity are actually substantially lower than they are in the U.S. India, in urban environments, you do see increases in obesity, and there's certainly increases in obesity in Latin American countries and in the Caribbean as well, and it will be a challenge. I think the best way to address this has been, quite frankly, I think we're at the point from a public health perspective where we're at the experimentation phase. Brazil has recently started a program that doesn't just look at the issue of salt consumption and processed fatty food consumption. They also have a public exercise program that they've set up in some of their cities, which involve building more parks, engaging people, having government professionals work with public exercise programs to get people out there and more active. That seems to be leading to some preliminarily positive results, but I think we need more evidence of that. But I think this is where the pilot programs really come in on these challenges that we don't have good answers yet. They're not where tobacco control is in terms of the evidence. I think we need to pilot programs, monitor them, and then when they work, bring them to scale. But I think we're still pretty early days on global obesity.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from the University of Texas at Austin. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. Our question is on compulsory licensing, cancer being one of the big four among the NCDs being talked about, and India's use of compulsory licensing this year to allow generic production of Nexavar, the first of its kind. more countries, Indonesia, China, to name a few, are doing it. The question is, what will be the repercussions of using compulsory licensing to increase access to medicines for NCDs, and how will this play out in TRIPS-related negotiations in the future?
Good and quite sophisticated question on compulsory licensing. So for those on the call that are less familiar with this tool, it's a form of expropriation that exists in many areas of law. So if I'm building a highway, if I'm the government and I wish to build a highway and your property is between where I need this highway to go, I can offer to buy that property from you. If you do not wish to sell it to me, I can actually, the government can take it in the public interest and give you compensation for doing so. Compulsory licensing is the same thing, but on patents. What it allows a government to do is to say, no longer is this invention just your exclusive, you no longer do you have the ability to exclude everyone from this invention. I will grant licenses to a few in the interest of the public. And the way this reduces prices of medicines is by bringing in competition. If you have more than one entity using a or producing a patented drug, prices will decrease just from competition. So that's what compulsory license is. It's provided under the international agreement that exists around intellectual property. It has long been a controversial issue in the question of access to medicines. Came up a lot when I worked in South Africa around HIV medications, and it did so because HIV was a epidemic that started in first world countries first, and for that reason, there were products to address these to address that disease. Many diseases such as tuberculosis or malaria, which are really problems, have been problems of low-income countries predominantly. You don't have as many products historically to treat those diseases because there hasn't been the high-income population to buy them. What one of the challenges that will arise from non-communicable diseases is that cancer, diabetes, cardiovascular diseases have been high-income country problems first. So there are medications to address these diseases, and you see a similar dynamic that's going to happen around whether or not these treatments will be at a price where people can afford them in low- and middle-income countries. And as the questioner from UT had mentioned, there has been some use of compulsory licensing in a few countries as a way of trying to reduce the price of cancer drugs. I don't think people are clear yet about how big of an issue this is going to be, mostly because the most cost-effective treatments for non-communicable diseases are generally off-patent. There are some instances where cancer medications are quite high-priced. The challenge that will occur through non-communicable diseases on those medications is they're also often very complicated to manufacture. So whether or not this will be a long-term solution to getting access to cancer drugs, I'm a little bit skeptical, mostly because I don't think every country will have the ability to manufacture them. And again, all a compulsory license allows you to do is to grant the ability to a manufacturer in that country to produce the product. And if you're not India or another country that has a large pharmaceutical sector, you may not be able to do this. I do think, more broadly speaking, the issue of pricing on non-communicable diseases is going to be a real challenge as these diseases become more and more prevalent and as more investment goes in trying to resolve these diseases and new treatments emerge. The affordability of these medications is going to be a big issue, and I don't think there is an easy answer to how that is going to be solved as of yet. The way it was solved on HIV/AIDS is a lot of the pharmaceutical companies priced this after the public relations challenges of not providing these more widely in low-income countries, started to price them much more cheaply in those markets, issue voluntary licenses to generic manufacturers in those countries to reduce the prices of these medications. I think they were willing to do that because it was a very small set of diseases on which they didn't make a lot of money in those low-income countries. cancer, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, however, are involve many more people, and they involve high-income markets as well, and I'm not sure the solutions that emerge around HIV/AIDS will be available for non-communicable diseases. So stay tuned. It's going to be a big issue moving forward.
Thank you for your question. Again, if you have a question, please dial star 1 on your touchtone phone now.
Can you talk a little bit about the role of multinationals in dealing with these NCDs and also in vis-a-vis tobacco companies and the beverage companies that are sort of at the heart of some of this? How are they addressing these issues and what are they doing?
Well, the tobacco company, unfortunately, you have to really put off to the side in that, as the former director general of the WHO once said, tobacco is the one consumer product when used as directed kills you. There is really no healthy use of tobacco. It is always bad for you. And in that sense, one of the things that provisions of this international treaty I mentioned on tobacco control is that tobacco companies are, from the signatories, the countries that have signed on to this treaty are meant to be excluded from any public health discussion of how to address these issues because, quite simply, again, there is no good use of that product. So putting the tobacco industry off to the side, I think the case is different on food and beverage companies, where there are healthy uses of those products, and it's more of an issue of trying to shift them in that direction. I think this is an area of real debate out there about how best to engage them. I think many feel that, you know, using the New York model, New York City model, it's really by the threat or the actual implementation of mandatory regulations to reduce content of unhealthy ingredients in products that you bring that industry to the table and they are able to, and you're able to see progress. Others believe that it should be public education campaigns and cooperation with those industries to try to get them to change their practices in a more healthy direction and then advocate for moderation in terms of consumption of unhealthy products. I personally believe it's a combination of the two that are likely to succeed. I think a case can be made on Pepsi, for instance, has and Campbell Soup have both tried to reduce the salt content in their food. And I think they have struggled because other companies in those industries have simply just left the salt where it is and without the ability to get consensus across the companies with which they compete, they've been undercut. We like salt in our food. It tastes good, even if it is bad for us. And, they started to lose market share. So that's the case for mandatory regulations, or at least a credible threat of regulation, is that it actually helps companies that want to do the right thing by forcing everybody to play on a level playing field. And that's the case for doing that in terms instead of voluntary measures. I think voluntary measures do have a role to play here as well, though, because I think there isn't consensus on a variety of issues. There just isn't consensus on the right amount of alcohol reduction or even, quite frankly, in some issues, the right amount of salt reduction. And I think the only way to start to make progress on that is working with industry, monitoring what is happening and the evidence of what the results of that is. And that may lead over time to more mandatory restrictions, but I think in terms of where we are in terms of political consensus at this point, I think you need to start with some voluntary partnerships in those areas. Again, tobacco is a different issue, though.
Right. You mentioned what the city of New York is doing. Michael Bloomberg, Mayor Michael Bloomberg, has banned, what is it, 18 ounces? Or
16 ounces.
16 ounces. Are other mayors across the country adopting this?
On the soda front, not as of yet, but as you know, a lot of the other innovations that have come out of New York City have been adopted. There have been a number of cities that adopted the ban on trans fats in food. New York City was, again, the first in the U.S., first major city in the U.S. to adopt this ban on smoking in public places. That has been adopted. And apparently, in terms of its popular support, the New York City public is coming around to this restriction on the size of beverages. And the public health evidence is pretty clear. As much as I know it's been criticized as a potential overreach, it's an effective intervention for dealing with the challenges of sugar consumption. There's been ample evidence to show that. So I would not be surprised as time goes on if the mayor sees more people implementing this solution as well. But as far as I know, no other city has adopted the restriction on beverage sizes. But I may have missed something, but I haven't heard of it.
Great. I think we have time for one last question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from UCLA. Please go ahead.
Hi. I just had a quick question about the tobacco industry. Now that they're setting their sights on lower-income countries, what are some of the challenges that you face kind of challenging this kind of force?
Sure. So it is true. Tobacco use is declining in high-income settings. In the U.S., for instance, it has halved. From in the 1960s, 42% of adults smoked. We are now, I think, something in the area of 16% of U.S. adults smoke. So you've seen dramatic reductions, and they've, of course, been driven by stronger tobacco control measures. That's happening in a lot of developed countries, and that is leading the tobacco industry to target low and middle-income countries as the growth market for the future. The one mention, given the shortness of time, that I'll emphasize here is trade has been an issue. So tobacco companies have leveraged the dispute resolution provisions that exist under trade agreements as a way of trying to bully low- and middle-income countries that are adopting the same tobacco control measures that we have here in the U.S. An example of this is Uruguay, which is adopting a similar graphic labeling provision that we have here in the U.S. and a number of other countries have, and are being sued under a bilateral investment treaty, which is a treaty around investment between two countries with Uruguay. I think Switzerland is the other country in this particular case. And they are suing under that treaty to try to stop the provision. Now, for a country like Uruguay, it does not have a budget set aside to handle trade disputes. And I think what you would have seen ordinarily is Uruguay would have looked to settle somehow. They simply don't have the resources to engage on this issue in a long, prolonged fight with the tobacco industry. And what ended up happening in that case is there was a New York Times report of the dispute and on the case, and Mayor Bloomberg, through his foundation, has provided the money to Uruguay to be able to defend that dispute. That, of course, is not a sustainable solution for all low- and middle-income countries. I can't imagine the mayor will be able to come to the rescue for all those countries. So we'll have to look for better ways of allowing them to stand on equal footing in trade disputes. But it's a great question.
Wonderful. This has been a terrific hour. I appreciate your taking the time to do this. And I hope that all of you, as I mentioned, Thomas Boyke is our Senior Fellow for Global Health, Economics, and Development here at CFR, and this issue of non-communicable diseases is obviously one that we're really paying attention to, and he's devoting all of his time researching and writing about. So I hope you will follow him on our website at cfr.org. Our next call will be on Wednesday, November 7th. At noon, again, Eastern Time, Bernard Gordon, who's a professor emeritus of political science at the University of New Hampshire, will talk about a recent foreign affairs article that he authored on the future of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So I hope you all will join us for that. And again, Thomas, thanks very much for today's insightful call.
My pleasure. Thanks to everyone who participated.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.